Hi everyone, it's Stu here, your dulcet-toned podcast host. Are you tired of ads interrupting your favourite true crime podcast? British Murders, of course. I mean, who needs a 60-second detour when you're in the midst of an immensely well-told story? The irony of this being an ad isn't lost on me, but I wanted to let you know that you can listen to British Murders completely ad-free by signing up for a Patreon membership. For as little as £3 per month, you'll get early access to ad-free episodes, as well as a heap of other benefits. I've got a fair few bonus episodes you can sink your teeth into, and every Monday I drop a new episode of the British Murders Weekly Journal. If you enjoy exclusive giveaways, my Patreon has those too. Head to patreon.com/britishmurders and choose either my OBE or KBE/DBE tier to rid yourself of those pesky adverts. Plus, you'll be helping support your favourite podcast so that I can offer you even more content going forward. I'd say that I'll shut up now, but you've got the rest of the episode to listen to. Back to you, Stu.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Murders, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to British Murders, the podcast focusing exclusively on listener-suggested British murder cases. I'm your host Stuart Blues and this is the third episode of Season 13. Before we get into the story, let's break the ice. The show's first opening icebreaker segment is this.
True facts that sound like bullshit.
Did you know that a hippo's jaw opens wide enough to fit a sports car inside? With the largest mouth and teeth of any land mammal and the strongest bite of all land animals, a hippo is able to spread its lips through a jaw-dropping 150 degrees and up to 1.2 metres in width. That's roughly 4 feet. Now it's time for the show's final opening icebreaker segment.
Random quote of the day.
Every cliche about kids is true. They grow up so quickly, you blink and they're gone. And you have to spend the time with them now. But that's a joy. That was said by Liam Neeson. This case was requested by Ross Scott on Messenger. We're in the village of Sion Mills this week, located in County Tyrone, Northern Ireland. It's located 16 miles south of Londonderry, 64 miles west of Belfast, and 383 miles northwest of London. Here are a few quickfire facts about Sion Mills. Number 1. Deriving its name from Sidine, meaning fairy mound, Sion Mills owes its development to the Herdman family, who established a thriving flax-spinning industry there in 1835 on the banks of the River Mourne. Number 2. Herdman's flax-spinning mill was built in 1835 by the brothers James, John and George Herdman from Belfast. Sion Mills was chosen as a rural area of high employment and with enormous water power. And at one point in time, Herdman's flax mill was one of the largest manufacturers in the province with a workforce of around 1,000. Number 3, Sion Mills was designated a conservation area in 1977. The tree-lined village is rich in architectural heritage. And number 4, formerly a 19th century stable block attached to the nearby Sion House called Sion Stables, has won awards for the way in which the listed building has been sensitively conserved and brought to life again. It now houses a museum, a licensed restaurant and seminar room, and is an initiative of Sion Mills Buildings Preservation Trust and Hearth. According to the 2011 census, the estimated population of Sion Mills was 1,907. This is the first time I've ever covered a case in Northern Ireland. It's only taken me 13 seasons to pluck up the courage to do so, and I'll apologise in advance for any mispronunciations. There's been a recent influx of case suggestions from Northern Ireland, so I figured it's probably time to cover one. The lady whose story I'm telling this week was born on January 31st, 1938, with her birth name being Bridget Attractor Mary O'Driscoll, although she would later be known more commonly by her middle name, Attractor. She was one of a few kids to her parents. There isn't too much information available about Attractor's early life and school years, but at some point she married a man called Michael Harron, with whom she'd go on to have, if I'm not mistaken, 5 children. Living in a lovely detached house on Curly Hill Road in the town of Strabane, Attractor and Michael appear to have had their own business at one point called Cuchullin Celtic Crafts Limited. Incorporated on June 6, 1986, the business was registered at the married couple's address, and based on the name alone, one assumes it was some kind of personalised crafting store so named after Irish folklore hero Cuchullin. I'm unsure if it's pronounced Cuchullin or Cuchullin. I saw it broken down as both in different sources, so again, apologies if I chose the wrong one. Aside from the family business, which has long since dissolved, Attractor was well known amongst her local community for being a devoted mum to her kids and a loving wife who adored her husband. She was always the one responsible for organising large get-togethers with everyone in the extended family whenever there was cause for celebration, whether that be a birthday, an engagement, or the passing of an exam. It's safe to say Attractor's parties were notorious not only for their scale, but for how much of a good time everyone had whilst attending them. Her outgoing personality suited her passion for entertaining and hosting, so she fit the bill perfectly. At the age of 65 during this story's events, Attractor was a keen fitness enthusiast whose favourite exercise was walking. She'd been on a bit of a health kick throughout the latter months of 2003, and walking to and from everywhere she went was part of her new regime. She was in excellent health as a result of getting out and about in the fresh air, and it no doubt also did wonders for her social life, as she'll have been able to stop and chat with others who were also out walking. In Attractor's life, she had two things at the top of her priority list. One was her family, and the other was her religion. A devout Roman Catholic, Attractor regularly attended Mass at St. Patrick's Church in the parish of Clonlea Liffey, the same church in which she and Michael tied the knot some decades earlier. Attending church was part of her daily routine, and she also sang in the church choir. Spending most of her working life as a librarian in Strabane, Attractor retired shortly before the end of 2003 and was in the middle of a special 30-day novena prayer sequence during this story's main timeline. According to CatholicLink.org, the intention of a novena is to obtain a special grace or intention. It's a petition that needs to be taken to God's ears, and to ensure that it's heard, you need to persevere, hence the consecutive days of repetition. Typically, it's done for 9 days. Novena comes from the Latin word novem, meaning 9, but sometimes an extended period of prayer can be undertaken. The intention of Attractor's novena was to help one of her daughters, who'd recently had some health issues and was also due to attend a job interview at Queen's University Belfast. On the morning of Thursday, December 11th, 2003, Attractor attended morning mass at St. Patrick's, arriving by foot, as she always did, with the plan being to walk straight home after. Located on the R264 road, St. Patrick's was just over a couple of miles away from Attractor's home, so the journey would have likely taken her an hour or so each way. Based on some quick research, a typical daily morning mass during the week lasts around 30 to 45 minutes, meaning Attractor likely headed home between 9:30 and 10 a.m. Given that walk home was a long one, she would sometimes accept lifts from people, especially when she was reasonably close to her home, as she'll have no doubt been fatigued by that point. Attractor was an optimist and always strived to see the best in people, so it didn't matter whether she got into a car with a stranger or a familiar face. Her trusting nature was one of her most endearing traits, but it is also thought to have been the very thing that allowed the person who took her life to take advantage of her. Several witnesses recalled seeing Attractor making her way home that morning, not only because they recognised her face, but because she was supposedly wearing some items of clothing that have been described as being very distinctive. She was spotted walking over the bridge that crosses the River Foyle, which connects Liffey and Strabane, at around 10:45 a.m, with CCTV cameras capturing her a short while later as she walked past a car garage on Liffey Road. Those would be the last official sightings of Attractor that morning, as she never arrived back home. It was so unlike her not to come back, because not only was she a stickler for routine, but she also had plans with one of her daughters to go Christmas shopping, given the big day was just 2 weeks away. She had plans for a massive family gathering at Christmas, so it lacked sense for her to go AWOL, especially at that time of year. As the hours ticked by and there was still no sign of a tractor, her family became extremely worried. They set out retracing her steps to and from the church, but there was no sign of her. The police were soon contacted and a missing person inquiry was launched, which led to a local farmer called Edwin McCauley getting in touch with the police on December 14th, 3 days after a tractor went missing. Edward said he recalled seeing a woman matching a tractor's description on the morning of December 11th between roughly 10 and 11:30 a.m. in the passenger seat of a car being driven by someone else on Orchard Road. Located near the village of Sion Mills, Edward was on his tractor at the time, his farm was nearby, and said the car he spotted was driving in the opposite direction at quite some speed, which made him notice it. He described what he called red streaks on the woman's face, which he thought looked like blood. Edward also noted that she was frantically moving her hands up and down over her chest. So focused was Edward on the woman, who appeared to be in trouble and in hindsight after the fact matched the description of a tractor, that he didn't take much notice of the driver in the brief glimpse he got. He said the woman had blonde hair, and so did a tractor, and was wearing red clothing that stood out. As the weeks leading up to Christmas passed with frightening speed, Michael and the kids received a glimmer of hope when they heard through the grapevine that a tractor had been spotted by someone south of the border in Dublin. A tractor's family spent that Christmas day in the freezing capital city of the Republic of Ireland, frantically searching for her, but to no avail. They soon returned home dejected and more concerned than ever. The new year came and went without any new information coming to light, but in the background, police were growing concerned due to a phone call made to the fire brigade in the early afternoon of December 11th, just a couple of hours after a tractor was last seen alive. At 12:57 p.m. that day, a woman called 999 and requested a fire engine be sent to a property on Concess Road, just outside the centre of Sion Mills. Arriving there shortly after the call was made, the fire brigade quickly dealt with a car fire at the property before wiping their brows at just how lucky the family were, given it was parked directly next to an oil tank. The red Hyundai Elantra belonged to one Trevor William Hamilton, the nephew of the woman who dialed 999 and a resident at the property. Bizarrely, she wasn't at the property when the fire brigade arrived, so it lacked sense as to why Hamilton, the only person in at the time, didn't do it himself, given he had access to the landline. When questioned about the fire, Hamilton insisted he'd been in the house all day and had no idea how it had started. When the car was later examined, it was determined that the fire had been deliberately set, with the suspected ignition location being the front passenger seat. With Concess Road and Orchard Road only being a couple of miles apart, the latter of which being the road the farmer said he spotted a tractor Harron on, plus the coincidental timing of the 999 call, Hamilton fell under suspicion. On February 20th, 2004, victim recovery dogs were sent from England to examine a few vehicles, one of which was Hamilton's red Elantra. Police video footage, possibly body cam, showed a Springer Spaniel examining a couple of cars and a van with no reaction before finally examining Hamilton's car. Springer Spaniels are one of the most frequently used sniffer dog breeds in the UK due to their broad nostrils and incredible sense of smell. The dog immediately became excited as soon as it entered the red Elantra and refused to get out. That was enough for the police to justify further forensic examination of the car, which led to some disturbing findings. A series of bloodstains were found inside, including on a car mat taken from one of the back seats. As the samples were sent away for analysis, a warrant was issued, allowing detectives to search Hamilton's home and the grounds. Inside the house, the following items were recovered: rosary beads, blue plasters, a religious text, a business card, a piece of red material, and an AIB bank receipt. AIB stands for Allied Irish Banks. Each of the recovered items would soon be confirmed as belonging to a tractor or her husband. The rosary beads were identical to a set owned by Michael. The blue plasters were some of the very ones purchased by a tractor in Lidl, as they had the same batch number. The religious text was a book of devotions, possibly from a local church service or a local shop. The business card was given to a tractor by an architect friend of hers who was involved in designing a new library in Strabane, and the bank receipt was from a wedding she and Michael attended on September 5th. Regarding the piece of red material, which also contained traces of blood, that was examined alongside filaments of fibre taken from the Haran family car. They matched. The blood found on the car mat was later examined and compared with a tractor's DNA profile, and that was also a match. The chances of the blood not being a tractor's was a billion to one. Further damning evidence showed that Hamilton had in fact left the house that morning. Cell phone towers proved this, and given the fact his mum and dad were out all day, the then 21-year-old was free to come and go as he pleased and do what he wanted at the property. I'm getting a tad ahead of myself though, aren't I? Because I mentioned the blood found matching a tractor's DNA, yet a body has still not been found. Before I explain where and when she was found, let me take you back in time a wee bit and tell you about the concerning past of Hamilton.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
Born and raised in Sion Mills, Hamilton earned a living as a farm labourer. And although not much is known about his upbringing, a fair few sources I used pointed towards his low intelligence perhaps playing a factor in some of the incidents he was involved in growing up. It's hardly an excuse though, because although his IQ was reportedly 68, classed as extremely low, it still wasn't low enough to hinder his perception of right and wrong. He also had no history of mental illness or abnormality of personality based on medical evidence, so using that as a means of looking to understand why he did the things he did, for me, lacks sense. His trouble with the police started from as young as 12, when he began publicly flashing women, typically in their 20s, who were simply going about their business. Hamilton's deviant behaviour continued well into his teenage years before receiving his first major criminal conviction on December 17, 1999, at the age of 17. He was convicted of 5 counts of indecent behaviour, which included public masturbation and exposing himself to female drivers on country roads between May 12th and June 25th, 1998. He'll have been 15 going on 16 at the time. Pleading guilty to the charges, Hamilton was placed on probation for 2 years, with him being referred to Bernardo's Therapeutic Project. I'm unsure if that is similar to their mandala therapy service, I don't think it is, but the one Hamilton was referred to was for young sexual offenders and was set to begin in February 2000. That same month, on February 16th, Hamilton sexually assaulted a 29-year-old mother of two called Helen Harper as she waited for her bus to arrive, which was due to take her from Sion Mills to Newton Stewart. It was roughly 3 p.m. when Hamilton slowed his car down by the bus stop and offered Helen a lift, which she accepted, as she seems to have known him to some degree based on the research I did. Helen had no idea about the nefarious intention of Hamilton's seemingly kind-hearted gesture and was subjected to a violent assault by the 17-year-old inside a caravan on the grounds of his family home on Concess Road. I want to confirm that Helen, who did have the right to anonymity as a rape victim, chose to waive it when she opened up about her ordeal for the first time in August 2006 when she did an interview with the Belfast Telegraph. Prior to that, she was referred to as Ms. H. She revealed during that interview just how devastating an effect the prolonged assault by Hamilton had on her well-being. So traumatised was Helen that when a consultant psychiatrist examined her in July 2000, she was said to be suffering from a moderately severe depressive episode. Helen was so fearful of another similar assault happening that her social life suffered greatly, as did her physical and mental health. She lost a significant amount of weight due to her lack of appetite, suffered frequent panic attacks, had stomach problems, and found it difficult to stay enthused and focused regardless of what she was doing. When Hamilton's murder trial took place in 2006, Helen was unable to attend court to testify against him, such was the level of her trauma. A statement of hers was subsequently read out by a third party as a result. The trial for Hamilton's assault on Helen took place in the autumn of 2000, with him only pleading guilty at the last second when his day in court eventually arrived. On September 19th at Enniskillen Crown Court, Hamilton was found guilty of rape, attempted buggery, indecent assault, and making a threat to kill. Mr. Justice Foote handed him the same sentence on each charge to be served concurrently, a custody probation order consisting of 3 years and 11 months detention in a young offenders centre, followed by 3 years supervision by a probation officer, 6 years in total. Given he were just 17, Hamilton could count himself lucky that he was handed such a lenient sentence. Had he been a few years older, he'd have been served a prison sentence well into the double figures, so said one source. On January 25, 2002, Hamilton's sentence was increased by the Court of Appeal due to it being classed as being unduly lenient. Hamilton saw his sentence increase by just 1 year, however, as it increased from 6 years to seven. Here's where the story gets a bit controversial. On August 18, 2003, after serving precisely 3.5 years of his 7-year sentence, Hamilton was released from Hyde Bank Wood Prison. In Ulster, there was a 50% remission policy in place at the time, something that was introduced in the province in 1976 in response to difficulties housing prisoners. Basically, it meant that even high-risk sex offenders, of which Hamilton was classed as a Category 3, the highest risk, could walk out of prison after serving 50% of their sentence. He was subject to the management of the local area Sex Offender Risk Management Committee upon his release and was given a designated risk manager from the probation service. He was given probation-approved premises to live in after his release, but he refused to stay there. Instead, he remained at his family home and would not leave. Despite being such a high risk to women, Hamilton was free to roam about his local area, and Helen Harper said the following when recalling the frightening moment she randomly saw him on the street one day. "I felt cheated by the so-called system when he only served 3 years. I wasn't even told he was out. I saw him on the street. I made it clear to the police from the start. If he ever got out, there would be a next time, and that time he would kill. Then a woman goes missing because of the laws that let Trevor Hamilton out of prison." The woman she's referring to there is Attractor Harron. Just 4 months passed between Hamilton being released and Attractor going missing, which brings us back to the spring of 2004 when the police were narrowing in on their prime suspect in her disappearance. Hamilton was formally charged with Attractor's murder on March 28th, just over a week before her body was finally found by police sniffer dogs. On April 5th, an area behind Hamilton's family home was being examined, and it was in a shallow grave close to a stream at the back of the property where Attractor's body was discovered. The grave had been slightly concealed by way of some slabs being placed atop of it, which were later confirmed as having come from the back garden. Another piece of evidence was the sack Attractor's body was placed in being identical to others found inside the house. The car fire had been set in an attempt to destroy evidence, including Attractor's clothes, but remarkably, the forensic teams were able to recover blood samples matching Attractor's DNA profile from the burnt-out vehicle, as I mentioned earlier. Professor Jack Crane conducted Attractor's post-mortem and noted that she had a clean bill of health prior to being killed. Her cause of death appeared to be due to head injuries caused by blows from a heavy object, such as an axe or a hatchet. A deep cut on the left side of her scalp above her left ear and another behind her ear helped Professor Crane come to that conclusion, although Dr. John Rutherford, who reviewed the findings, said he could find no clear indication of a particular type of weapon being used. Both men also noted that there appeared to be no evidence of sexual assault. Attractor Harron was laid to rest on April 11, 2004, Easter Sunday, at her beloved St. Patrick's Church, less than a week after her body was discovered, as is the norm with those of the Roman Catholic faith. Mr. Justice McLaughlin oversaw Hamilton's murder trial in the packed courtroom number 1 at Dungannon Crown Court as it commenced on February 27, 2006. Hamilton continued to plead his innocence, but when the jury of 6 men and 6 women returned to the courtroom on April 12th after deliberating for just over 4 hours, they unanimously found him guilty. Handing Hamilton a life sentence, Mr. Justice McLaughlin said, I am satisfied, as was the jury, that you killed Mrs. Harron after abducting her, almost certainly after you offered her a lift when she was close to the centre of Strabane on her way home from Mass. What happened thereafter can be put together only partly, for it seems sure that Mr. Macaulay saw her in your car within a half hour of the last sighting of her in Strabane. The presence of her blood in the rear of the car, which must have been there before it was set on fire, means that she was almost certainly dead within an hour or so of her abduction. 6 months later, Mr. Justice McLaughlin made history by upgrading Hamilton's sentence to a whole life order on August 4th, the first time such a sentence had been handed down to anyone in Northern Ireland since the introduction of the Life Sentences Northern Ireland Order 2001. A month later, Hamilton was viciously assaulted in Magaberry Prison by a fellow inmate as a group of onlookers cheered him on. An insider said, "Several people had enough of him swaggering about bragging, so he received a beating." Despite being kicked and punched repeatedly, Hamilton was not seriously injured, suffering nothing more than a few cuts and bruises. In October, the Mirror revealed Hamilton was writing intimate letters to someone who he thought was a young female, but was in fact a correspondent for the paper. Upon studying the letters, crime expert Paul Roffey said, "Hamilton is writing letters that appear to the untrained eye to be totally innocent, but they are not. He is effectively grooming the person he is writing to, and that's why the letters are so powerful." Here's an example of something Hamilton wrote in one of the letters. "To be honest, it's been enough to reduce me to tears and wish I'd never wake up, but I'm over that now and want to keep going to prove everyone wrong. I don't have a girlfriend. What about you? Do you have a boyfriend? I've been trying to put a face to your letters. Hopefully one day I'll get to meet you." For the record, every letter sent and received was thoroughly checked according to prison authorities, and they had no concerns regarding the content of Hamilton's letters. A huge boost then came on December 5th of that year, as history was made once more when the government eradicated its 50% remission policy for dangerous prisoners. The move came on the back of immense pressure put to them after a petition launched by the Belfast Telegraph garnered over 35,000 signatures from their readers. The campaign, called Justice for Attractor, was so well backed that the government were left with no choice but to abolish the policy. Michael Harron said after the change, "On the day of Hamilton's sentencing, we called for the end of 50% remission, and the Belfast Telegraph's campaign has demonstrated how much the public wanted this also. However, there are still further actions which could be taken to improve the situation here in Northern Ireland, and I await with interest to see whether the Minister has picked up on them." When Hamilton received his whole life order sentence upgrade, he appealed immediately. At his Court of Appeal hearing on May 19, 2008, his legal team said it was just the whole life order he was appealing rather than the verdict, something he had originally also appealed. On June 27th, Lord Chief Justice Kerr, sitting with Lord Justices Campbell and Higgins, concluded that the whole term order made by the judge must be quashed and instead handed Hamilton a minimum term of 35 years. In the appeal document, the following justification is provided. "The imposition of a whole life tariff should be confined to those instances where the facts of the case, considered as a whole, will leave the judge in no doubt that the offender must be kept in prison for the rest of his or her life." While this was a heinous offence that must rank as one of the most grave that our community has suffered, after much anxious thought, none of the members of the panel who heard the appeal felt that this was a case in which he could feel no doubt that the appealant should remain in prison for the rest of his life. "We wish to emphasise that our decision does not mean that the appealant will be released at the expiry of the minimum term that we have imposed. It will then be a matter for the parole commissioners to decide whether it is safe to release him. Only if it is concluded that he no longer represents a danger to the public will his release ever be authorised. On the present evidence, there is every prospect that that day will never come." And that was the story of the murder of Attractor Harron. Thanks again, Ross Scott, for requesting it. I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts. This week's new reviews are as follows. Judy Watkins left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, "Love the concise episodes, love your accent. Just wondering, I had relatives in Slathwaite. Did your gran know Sheila and Ron Kay? My grandparents were also from around that district, Cartwright and Batley. Keep up the great shows. Cheers, Judy Watkins, southwest of West Australia, Busselton. I honestly couldn't tell you, Judy. If my mum's listening, she might know. Kayla Elizabeth Cook left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, fantastic podcast which covers interesting cases, some of which are not well known to the wider public. Stu retells these crimes, focusing on the victims and the main informative points of each case. I love the 5 facts about the locations and also the intro sections with your daughter's voice. She's cute. I enjoyed your coverage of Robert Black as I grew up in Uttoxeter, and even though Susan Maxwell was found 10 years before I was born, I was very aware of this case while growing up. This is one of the main podcasts that I use to find cases for my criminology course that I'm currently doing. Can I suggest the case of Donald Nielsen, the Black Panther? I've just researched this case for my studies and would love to hear your take on it. Thank you, Stu, for your hard work. Keep it up. It's on my list, Kayla, and you're now the 6th person to request that one, so I probably should cover it soon. Good luck with your studies, by the way. And finally, Lily Gathright left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, hello from America. Not doing an accent this week. I have been listening to this podcast for a while now, and I really enjoy it. The episodes are short, so I can hear the whole thing and not worry about getting bored, and it's nice to listen to while I go about my day. It's safe to say this is one of my favourite podcasts now. Thank you, Stuart. No. Thank you, Judy, Kayla and Lily, for leaving those reviews. If anyone listening wants to leave a review and have it read on a future episode, just head to iTunes, Facebook, Podchaser or BritishMurders.com. Please keep leaving those star ratings on Spotify. And why not head to patreon.com/BritishMurders? If you sign up for an OBE or CBE tier, you'll get early and ad-free access to all my future episodes. You'll gain access to several bonus episodes, regular giveaways, welcome goodies, and my British Murders Weekly Journal series. Hello and welcome to my newest Patreon members, Holly Zdrenka and Celia Miller. Hope I'm saying your surname right, Holly. If you'd prefer to support the show on a one-off basis, you can do so by heading to buymeacoffee.com/BritishMurders. That's just what Julia H did. Thanks for buying me 5 beers on there. The message left was, love your cast. Please keep sending me your case suggestions to contact@BritishMurders.com or message me on social media. I'm not great at getting back to messages, I'm not going to lie. Email's probably the best way to go about it. When I cover your case, you'll get a shout out for your trouble, just like Ross did. If you don't want a shout out, just let me know and I'll make a note that you want to be anonymous. And that does it for another episode. My first case in Northern Ireland. How did I do? How was my pronunciation? Let me know. I'm sure you will, because you always do. I've been Stuart Blues. This has been British Murders. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time. Cheerio.